dia a tothom. Buenos días. Good morning. Se nos ha pedido que en esta primera ronda hablemos nuestra lengua y quizás luego la discusión pasemos al inglés. Pero, ante todo, gracias por la oportunidad de estar moderando aquí este debate y hacerlo también en nombre del Círculo de Economía, a cuya Junta Directiva me honro en pertenecer, este ciclo coorganizado con el Centro de Asuntos Internacionales, CIDOB, de Barcelona, y el Grupo de Opinión y Reflexión sobre Economía Política, EuropeG. Después de un periodo marcado por la gran recesión y haber dedicado muchos esfuerzos a remediar sus consecuencias macroeconómicas y los problemas de diseño de el euro, resulta imprescindible intentar recuperar la confianza de los ciudadanos europeos en un proyecto que no solo es económico, sino fundamentalmente político. Desde una perspectiva macro, si miramos las cosas hoy, parece que hemos progresado mucho. Esto nos dicen al menos las cifras. Pero la crisis ha dejado tras de sí una herencia de malestar social y de desapego. Y la pérdida de confianza en el futuro unida, o se refleja, por supuesto, también en un nacionalismo creciente y desafección ciudadana. Y todo esto se combina o se complica con la transformación digital y los miedos que existen, especialmente desde el punto de vista de algunos empleos, a sus consecuencias, la necesidad de hacer frente a la degradación del medio ambiente y la transición demográfica. Bueno, estos son desafíos muy importantes que trascienden las fronteras y que seguramente tienen como consecuencia que no podamos plantearnos respuestas autónomas y nacionales a estos asuntos y a estos desafíos. Y los ciudadanos europeos, paradójicamente, parecen volver sus ojos hacia Europa. Y puede ser curioso esto en tiempos de Brexit. Sé que no le gusta mucho al profesor Collier esta coyuntura, pero si uno mira el Eurobarómetro, que mide las actitudes de los ciudadanos europeos, uno se encuentra con que la popularidad de la Unión Europea y en particular del euro como moneda no ha hecho sino crecer en los últimos años. Así que hay una paradoja, hay como dos realidades paralelas. Populismos que surgen, antieuropeísmo, pero al mismo tiempo una confianza en que Europa nos puede proteger y dar soluciones. Y la mejor prueba es el incremento en participación ciudadana en las elecciones al Parlamento Europeo. Las últimas nada menos que 8 puntos por encima de las anteriores. Bien, para algunos Europa nos limita y nos daña. Para otros, afortunadamente, la gran mayoría, Europa nos protege y es una gran referencia y una esperanza para poder gobernar mejor la revolución tecnológica, frenar los excesos de una economía globalizada y consolidar el estado de bienestar. Una vez que tenemos en Europa instituciones, el Parlamento Europeo recién elegido, la Comisión que está a punto de tomar el testigo de la anterior, parece que es el momento de aprovechar esta ventana de oportunidad para pensar en serio en el pilar social de la Unión Europea. Europa tiene un componente de unión económica, de unión monetaria y, si se quiere, de unión política, pero ese pilar social parece que nos falta. Y junto a ello está el reto de hacer frente al cambio climático, este Green New Deal que está ahora en la boca de todo el mundo. Así que son temas muy importantes que hoy vamos a poder discutir. ¿Qué factores impiden, si es que los podemos enumerar, un crecimiento inclusivo y sostenible en el tiempo? ¿En qué medida es necesario avanzar hacia una Europa más unida o, por el contrario, podemos buscar soluciones nacionales? ¿Qué medidas son necesarias para cumplir con los objetivos de desarrollo sostenible? Yo creo que tenemos un panel de expertos difícil de superar y de ellos, pues, qué duda cabe, el profesor Collier es un profesor bien conocido de todos. Yo recuerdo muy bien su libro de The Bottom Billion, los mil millones de más abajo, donde realmente nos confronta con esas trampas a las que se enfrentan algunos países, como son la trampa del conflicto armado, la trampa de los recursos naturales, la trampa del tener malos vecinos y la trampa de la mala gobernanza, que combinadas hacen que algunos países se acerquen más a la edad media que no al siglo XXI en el que estamos. Bueno, pues hoy nos ayuda a pensar en estas cosas con una nueva aportación, con un título que, en fin, hay que estar a la altura de este título para realmente merecer aprecio y a fe que lo está. Es un libro brillante, El futuro del capitalismo, donde seguramente, parafraseando a Churchill, el capitalismo es el peor de los sistemas, descartados los demás que se han utilizado aquí y allí a lo largo del tiempo. Yo supongo que él estará de acuerdo con esto. Ha habido fallos en el sistema capitalista porque autónomamente no produce necesariamente siempre resultados éticos y resultados inclusivos. Y sin ética e inclusión, el capitalismo está abocado a desaparecer. Bien, junto a él intervendrán Ariane Omer, supongo que sí, se pronuncia así, aunque es coruñesa, y Miguel Otero Iglesias, pues también gallego y licenciado por la Universidad de Santiago de Compostela. Los dos tienen un bagaje internacional importante. Ariane está en el Instituto Universitario de Florencia y se enfoca en estado de bienestar. Miguel tiene un perfil muy diversificado, ha estudiado en Oxford, ha estudiado aparte de Santiago que he mencionado antes, pero también ha tenido relación con China, Estados Unidos, y en temas de, digamos, de política social y de geopolítica nos va a aportar cosas. Pero sin más, le doy paso a Paul Collier porque hemos de ser hoy muy disciplinados con el tiempo. Así que tiene usted la palabra y es realmente un placer tenerla aquí, profesor.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me and you know, for coming at this time of day. So, what's the future of capitalism about, and how does it bear on the on Europe? So, and especially how does it bear upon Europe's social pillar? So, let me start with a question, and then I'll detour and eventually come back to it. Where in Europe do you think the strongest support for Europe is? Which regions and which classes of people? And where do you think the strongest opposition is? Which regions and which classes of people? I won't answer that yet. I will in due course. But let me go back to the book. Yeah. And the book is about capitalism and what has gone wrong with it. And let me be clear, I believe capitalism is a vital system in 10,000 years of human civilization. It is the only system that we have discovered that has the capability of raising all living standards. Yeah. So capitalism is essential. We've not hit on any other system. But I don't believe that capitalism works on autopilot. Periodically, capitalism derails. We are not in a system that we fully understand. We don't, in economic terms, know the model. We can't know the model. I believe we face what's called radical uncertainty, that the world is far more complex than we can ever fully understand. And so there can be no guidebook to utopia. And indeed, there is no utopia. Yeah? We're in an evolving, highly complex system, and periodically, things go wrong. Capitalism derails. When it derails, the best you can do is then the pragmatic response of saying, how in this context has it gone wrong? What are the anxieties that it has now generated, the new anxieties? And what, given our understanding of this context, seems to be a good strategy for putting it back on the rails? And maybe we don't know. Maybe, in which case, we better try things. Try this, try that, and learn, right? As quickly as possible. And then it'll go back on the rails, and it might be on the rails for 70 years, it might be on the rails for 20, we don't know. It'll come off again, right? And then the same approach is required, right? So, I believe in capitalism as the vital system, but I don't believe it works on autopilot. In the 250 years of capitalism, I think it's derailed at least three times, big time. And the book is about the third derailment, which started across a lot of the OECD countries, a lot of the advanced world, around 1980, and has got worse and worse. I'll briefly take you back to the first derailment. Everybody knows about the second derailment, mass unemployment in the 30s, right? The first derailment occurred in my part of the world. I grew up 10 miles from the first factory on Earth. It's now a World Heritage Centre because of that. Right? This is the industrial cities of the north of England. And I'm going to take you briefly to the 1840s and the most booming city in the whole of Europe. My German grandfather moved there from a village in Germany. And this is Bradford, right? An industrial city in the north of England. Hugely productive. Right? And it's the nearest we've ever come outside the context of warfare to hell on earth. Because although people are hugely productive, as they're herded together in this city with no public infrastructure, no public policy, what collapses is life expectancy, health. The water, drinking water gets mixed up with the sewage, people are herded together and contagious diseases spread, and in 1849, there's cholera breaks out. Right? People are dying by their 100,000. And I'm going to take you not only to Bradford, I'm going to take you to Mester Big in Bradford, who's the biggest industrialist. He's called Titus Salt. He's not only the big industrialist, he's the big political figure. He's the mayor, and he's the city's one member of parliament. So he's really Mester Big. And there he is, mayor, and his citizens and his workers are dying day by the hundred. And it seems to have seared his soul, because he becomes the first industrial philanthropist on earth. He's a very rich man. He's the billionaire of his time. He gives away his entire fortune. Yeah. He recognizes his obligations to his workforce, and so he builds the first purpose-built town on earth for his workers. He was Titus Salt. It's called Saltaire. It's also a World Heritage Center because it was the world first. Right? He recognizes responsibilities to the local community. And so he uses the rest of his fortune to clear up Bradford. That's Bradford. We go a few miles from Bradford, still in the 1840s, we get to Rochdale. Same problems, right? Life expectancy collapsed to 19. You're dead on average at 19. What's the very real anxiety? If you're poor and you're going to die on average at 19, do I get a funeral? Or am I chucked into a pauper's grave? And so the families of Rochdale, so not the firms this time, the families, they decide, let's band together. I'll accept obligations for you. If you die first, I'll pay for your funeral, as long as you do the same for me. Reciprocal obligations. That is the world birth of the cooperative movement. Rochdale. Which then spread all over the world, that model of families dealing with very practical anxieties by building reciprocal obligations. Right? So we see both firms and families recognizing in a pragmatic way, here are new problems, and responding to it with these recognizing obligations. And just as Titus Salt recognizes obligations to his workers and his citizens, they responded with recognizing responsibilities to him. So they were loyal and they were very respectful. When he died, there was a huge funeral. There's a big statue of him in the middle of Bradford. He's still the hero. Right? And so this structure, firms recognized obligations, families recognized obligations. They were, in a very important phrase for the book, they were all morally load-bearing. And we got out of that nightmare of the 1840s by widely distributed moral load-bearing. Firms, families, local business community, local government, as well as the state. All these organizations work together. And now I come to the derailment of the that started in the 1980s. And it was a completely different derailment. It wasn't a public health crisis, just as it wasn't mass unemployment of the 1930s. What was the crisis that began in the 1980s? It was two new social rifts. One was a spatial rift. It was booming metropolitan areas. We're in one. Versus provincial towns and cities which started to break. And the economics behind that was globalization. More and more markets became global, and so there was room for fewer but bigger winners. I grew up in Sheffield, which had been a steel town for 700 years. And some of you will know what happened to Sheffield in the 1980s, because some of you will have seen the film The Full Monty. Eh? That's Sheffield. That's my relatives. Eh? It was a very funny film, very poignant. It was a ghastly experience. Eh? I straddle that spatial divide. I now live in the ultimate district of metropolitan success, which is North Oxford. My postcode has the highest ratio of house prices to income in the whole of Britain. I'm Mr. Metropolitan Success. But all my family is in a city that became broken. Right? And so I happen to straddle that spatial rift. Right? And there's another rift which opened up, which was about education and skill. And so people who got a good education, like me, we built on that education fancy new skills which became more and more valuable. Meanwhile, the people who hadn't had a good education, they'd invested in manual skills. And they became less and less valuable. Again, there's a very simple economic process that was producing that divide, which is the price you pay for higher productivity is greater complexity. You do the obvious things in the 19th century, the fairly obvious things in the first half of the 20th century. By the late 20th century, to increase productivity, you have to do complex things. Complex things require a base of a good education. And what rising complexity does is destroy the value of a lot of the manual skills. So we've got one bunch, the metropolitan skilled on a rising escalator for 40 years, and another bunch, the provincial, less the manual skilled, who are on a falling escalator. Yeah? These two trends then intertwine, because if you're a bright kid from the provinces, from a broken provincial city, what you do like what I did, you get out. And that's good news for you, but it's bad news for the people left behind. Okay? So, as it happens, I also straddle the educational divide. Right? I've had quite a lot of education. Right? And so I'm definitely part of the metropolitan skilled. But I was first generation, I was actually the only person in my family to do that. Both my parents left school when they were only 12 years old. And so the rest of my family is very firmly in the other half of the population. Right? So the book is quite a passionate book because I've lived this divide. This time, the derailment was not addressed. The derailment of the 1840s was fixed within 20 years. The derailment of the 1930s was fixed within 20 years. The derailment that began in the 1980s has just been left to get wider and wider. And there's an important question of why it was left. And partly the explanation is ideology. Ideology replaced pragmatism. On the right, you got the ideology of Milton Friedman. The sole purpose of the firm is to maximize value for shareholders. Right? And that is the ideology which says markets will work fine, they will lift all boats. The only role of the firm, in fact, the firm as an entity disappears in modern economic theory. The firm is just a structure of legal contracts. Contracts that specify what people should do and suppliers should do, and they'll be monitored. And if you comply with the contract, you'll get rewarded. This is the bonus culture in the investment banks. And if you don't comply, you'll be penalized. And so we've set up a structure in which firms actually disappear. Far from being morally load-bearing, they don't exist as an organizational entity. They're just a package of contracts. Right? That same model was actually imitated by some parts of the public sector. Britain pioneered using that business model in the public sector, and it's been catastrophic. So just to give you an example of the application, there's an annual survey called the Jobs and Skills Survey in Britain, which has asked the same question for 25 years. Have you got enough autonomy in your job to do it to your own satisfaction? And 25 years ago, most people said yes. Been a 40% drop in yes. Now most people say no, because they see themselves as automata within this structure of monitored contracts and incentives. So they're trapped. So we've shifted moral responsibility both off firms, off the workers in firms, and we've done the same thing in the families, in fact. And so what's happened? Where's the obligations gone? They've gone up to the state. And now who's left? We've become a world where there's just the state, which has the obligations, and individuals, which have rights. That's the meaning of human rights, individual rights. And so the political tension is between the state trying to bully people into doing the right thing and individuals pushing back saying, I want my freedom. That's a disastrous ethical structure for a society. It cannot possibly work. So the plea of the book is get back to this idea that lots of organizations in society need to be morally load-bearing. Firms need to become morally load-bearing again. They need to return to that system of being morally responsible. They need a purpose which can't be profit. If you're not profitable as a firm, you're not sustainable. So you've got to be profitable, but that's not your purpose. Your purpose is to find profitable solutions to the problems of society. And very encouragingly, there's a sea change very rapidly in firms responding to that. So the idea that firms are just there to maximize shareholder value is very rapidly being abandoned. I was at a business conference in Lisbon a couple of weeks ago where there was a young business community from all over Europe. They'd just been on a march through Lisbon, death of shareholder value. So it's widespread in the business community, as a sense. So that's business, local, community. We need to get back from this highly centralized state to local communities, both empowered local governments and empowered local businesses. There's only one city in Britain which has managed to get above average, national average productivity, apart from London, and that is Edinburgh. And that's because Edinburgh's managed fortuitously to look rather like Barcelona. It's had decentralized political power, a byproduct of Scottish nationalism. It's got its own legal system, and so it's got decentralized local financial institutions. They are vital. if you centralize your financial institutions in London, as Business Britain has done, you lose all the tacit knowledge that a good financial industry has of local business. And then you just rely on the codified knowledge, the tick box of the risk-weighted model, which says lend here and don't lend here, based on very little information about the true nature of the firm. So Edinburgh's got, unusually for Britain, decentralized political power, decentralized finance, and therefore in Edinburgh, the business community organizes locally. Here, you are a business community organized locally. Elsewhere in Britain, it's all in London because that's where the political power is and that's where the finance is. And so Britain has destroyed its local business communities. Right? Then you need good local universities doing the tertiary education, which is both training and pertinent research that keeps the firms at the frontier. And then finally, you need a strong cultural brand. Edinburgh's got it, thanks to the Edinburgh Festival. My goodness, Barcelona has it, right? And then finally, you put all that together and you do collaboration of those five entities for a forward-looking common purpose. So 10 years ago, all those entities came together in Edinburgh and they said, where are the jobs coming from in Edinburgh in 10, 20 years' time? And then they weren't very imaginative. They said, we need a sector which is a sector of the future, IT. Right? Not very imaginative, but that was an idea. Let's try and attract IT to Edinburgh. And then they did an inventory of how many IT firms have we got. They've got two. Not a good start, right? But they all worked on it, all these five entities, local government, local finance, local business community, universities, right? Well, 10 years later, they got 480 IT firms in Edinburgh. It's the largest single cluster of IT in the whole of Europe. So, common forward-looking purpose across these widely distributed organizations at a local level, that's the secret that works. But, and let me conclude by outraging some of you, we've described these two social divergences, the productive places, the metropoles, and the productive people. And what has very clearly happened in Britain and in America is that the successful people in the metropoles have peeled off from shared identity with everybody else in their society. And this is the renunciation of the sense of shared national citizenship. And who's renouncing it? The most successful people who've done best out of this rising escalator. Who's suffering from that shedding, that peeling off? People saying, I'm not part of the nation. Huh? Who's suffering from it? It's the people at the other end. The people who, their biggest asset is the claim on the successful. And just as they really need that claim because they're on a down escalator, the most successful are saying, we're nothing to do with you. Huh? We're citizens of the world or whatever. Huh? I'll illustrate that with one quote from a brilliant metropolitan commentator for the Financial Times, who had an article describing how he viewed provincial Britain and how he thought the rest of metropolitan, basically the rest of London, viewed provincial Britain. And he said, it feels like being shackled to a corpse, right? Locked in with a corpse. Do you hear the empathy of concern for a fellow citizen, right? Nor do I, right? This is frankly an ethical disgrace, right? And so that peeling off is, I think, repugnant. Of course, what it then produces are mutinies. If you neglect people who've been on the down escalator for long enough, they revolt, they mutiny. And like all mutinies, they're not strategies for the future, they're just expressions of rage. Brexit isn't a strategy for the future, it's a rebellion, not against Brussels. What on earth does Brussels have to do with it? Huh? It's a rebellion against London for prolonged neglect. Huh? The same is Trump. The same is the Gilets Jaunes. At least the Gilets Jaunes have the decency. I live in France part of the year. At least the Gilets Jaunes have a decency to say, we don't have a strategy. Huh? The most famous mutiny in the world, mutiny on the Bounty, was because the sailors were, there was only a limited amount of fresh water on the boat, and the captain gave the water to the plants that were being taken from the Pacific to London. Rather than to the sailors. And they thought that was rather unreasonable. And I can't say that, maybe I would have felt that it was a little unreasonable as well. What they didn't mutiny for was to end up on a little island of Pitcairn in the middle of nowhere. But that's where they ended up, right? Britain may well end up a little island in the middle of nowhere, but that's not why they're rebelling. As it were, they're rebelling because they've been neglected. These perfectly reversible rifts, the spatial rift and the educational rift, haven't been addressed. So just to finish, I started with the question, where's the support in Europe for the European Union? And unfortunately, I want to suggest that the support is strongest amongst the most educated people in the most successful regions. In Britain, the educated in London voted very heavily for Remain. Right? Every other region of Britain voted to leave. Right? Of course, my own part of North Oxford voted very heavily Remain. I did all I could to campaign for Remain. Right? And if we look around Europe, where is the opposition? It's not the metropolitan successful, it's the provincial unsuccessful. Now, I think that is catastrophic for European legitimacy. I think the Europe of the 2020s has to actually address these social rifts. We need social instruments that Brussels hasn't at the moment got to heal these rifts. They are perfectly healable, and I'm happy in the course of our discussion to discuss what can be done. But on Friday, I was in Brussels doing the keynote for ECOFIN, the Economics and Financial Directorates. And what I urged them was to build the social side of the European Union so that by the end of the 2020s, where is the support for the European Union? It's from the marginal people in the marginal regions who have looked to Europe and said, thank you, you've helped us catch up. So that's how I very much agree with you. We need that social window. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, profesor Collier, por estas estimulantes palabras. ¿No? Y sin más interrupción, tenemos ahora a Diane Ometre, que le pido por favor que suba al estrado y haga sus comentarios. Muchas gracias.
Perfecto. Muchas gracias. A ver, por aquí. Muy interesante todo lo que acabamos de escuchar, sobre todo sobre el capitalismo, el futuro, cómo podemos arreglar un poco estos desequilibrios en los que encontramos ahora mismo. Yo me voy a centrar un poco más en el rol de la Unión Europea en esto y especialmente en el rol de la política social, porque es lo que yo investigo y es donde más conozco. Yo trabajo especialmente sobre cómo cambia el contrato social y sobre qué elementos podrían evitar que el contrato social se siguiese rompiendo. Es cierto que de unos años a esta parte yo tengo la sensación de que se habla muchísimo de estas dos palabras. El contrato social está roto, ¿qué hacemos? ¿Qué hacemos? Sin embargo, cuando hablamos de reescribir el contrato social y de los retos que afrontamos, en general no se trata de retos nuevos. Son retos que llevan décadas ahí, que llevan décadas de algún modo sentando las bases y que han estallado un poco durante los últimos 10 años a raíz en gran parte en Europa de la crisis económica, pero elementos que acabamos de escuchar hablar ahora, pero no solo, como el cambio tecnológico, como la globalización, como la creciente desigualdad, el hecho de que la economía haya cambiado hacia una economía de servicios, la incorporación de la mujer al mercado laboral. Todos estos retos, estamos ahora mismo en 2019 y son elementos que empiezan a suceder a partir de los años 70, de los años 80, en los que el mundo empieza a cambiar. ¿Qué pasa ahora? ¿Por qué de repente hablamos tanto de esto? Bueno, hemos tenido una crisis durante la última década en Europa, que ha hecho que estas bases que estaban ahí, que generaban tensiones en nuestra economía y en nuestra sociedad, ya no solo sean síntomas, sino que se conviertan en realidades, se convierten en consecuencias. Y han tenido consecuencias para muchos sectores de la población. Entonces, ahora que en cierta medida ha pasado la crisis, vemos las consecuencias que ha tenido y decimos, ¿qué hacemos con todo esto? Pero algo que yo siempre pienso es que no podemos dar respuesta a cómo reescribir el contrato social centrándonos solo en estamos aquí ahora en 2019. Necesitamos entender de alguna manera qué es lo que hacía que el contrato social funcionase en los años 50, en los años 60, 70 en Europa, qué es lo que se ha roto y qué es lo que tenemos que arreglar. Porque no es un contrato social, no es algo que podamos reinventar desde cero. Tenemos unas bases en la sociedad, tenemos una serie de acuerdos no escritos que funcionaron durante muchas décadas. Entonces, yo siempre empiezo a pensar en esta historia a partir de los años 50, la época de la posguerra en Europa. Es un momento en el que se viene de una situación enorme de desempleo, como hemos mencionado antes, en los años 30. Y en este momento se diseñan los estados del bienestar en la mayoría de países europeos pensando en asegurar contra el riesgo de desempleo a las personas que trabajan, en su mayoría son hombres, y asegurar a la gente que llega a la tercera edad que no vaya a haber pobreza en la tercera edad. Porque estos eran los retos que hubo durante los años 30 y durante los años 40 y estos eran los problemas a los que se enfrentan los estados europeos durante la posguerra. Entonces, cuando se diseña la política social y cuando se diseñan los estados del bienestar, dentro de que en Europa hay muchísima variación en cómo se hace en base a unas economías industriales en las que la mayoría de gente tiene carreras laborales muy lineales y entonces es sencillo asegurar a la gente mediante un seguro de desempleo. Se diseñan teniendo en cuenta que la familia va a ser un pilar importante porque en la mayoría de familias es el hombre quien va a trabajar y la mujer se va a quedar en casa y entonces lo que son políticas de cuidado igual no son tan necesarias porque tenemos este arreglo en el que la familia hace de red social hasta cierto punto. Se hace todo en un contexto muy de economía industrial. En una situación en la que la economía aún no está globalizada, entonces los estados tienen un gran margen de maniobra para llevar a cabo sus políticas. Y todo esto es lo que os comentaba, que a partir de los años 70 empieza a cambiar. Las mujeres se incorporan al mercado laboral, la economía deja de ser industrial y nos movemos hacia lo que llamamos sociedades postindustriales, en las que la economía está muy basada en una economía de servicios y no vamos a volver a una situación en la que alguien entre a los 23 años en una empresa y salga a los 65 para jubilarse, porque el mundo ya no funciona así. Pero seguimos teniendo políticas públicas, sociales, diseñadas para que el mundo funcione así en muchos países. Y esto es lo que ha generado un desequilibrio. Se han generado una serie de tensiones y mientras todo iba bien, eran unas tensiones que estaban de algún modo en el aire, que podría llegar a pasar algo, pero tampoco necesariamente. Pero cuando llega la crisis, vemos las consecuencias y vemos cómo aumenta la desigualdad, vemos las consecuencias políticas de todo esto en términos de populismo, de descontento, de desafección, etcétera, etcétera. Y vemos una sociedad que necesita cambiar de alguna manera las bases de este contrato social. Y si pensamos en los retos de los que he estado hablando hasta ahora, cambio tecnológico, economía de servicios, desigualdad, globalización, no voy a hablar mucho del cambio climático porque no es mi especialidad para nada, pero todos estos son retos globales, son retos a los que no tiene ningún sentido enfrentarse de manera nacional, porque si todos nos estamos enfrentando al mismo tipo de procesos, al mismo tipo de transiciones, necesitamos, si no una respuesta global, porque el mundo es muy grande, las preferencias divergen y no siempre se puede ir todos juntos a todas partes, sí al menos una respuesta supranacional en términos de que yo creo que hay un consenso hasta cierto punto de que hay retos que no se pueden resolver país por país. Y en Europa, mi sensación es que tenemos muchísima suerte porque llevamos muchísimos años de integración europea y eso hace que tengamos las instituciones, los foros internacionales, los mecanismos. Tenemos la posibilidad y el marco político que nos permitiría avanzar hacia responder estos retos. No necesitamos empezar a construir de cero un uy, ¿cómo nos enfrentamos al cambio tecnológico? No, porque ya tenemos plataformas, instituciones, redes, etcétera, etcétera, que nos permiten empezar a construir desde un marco de confianza, de integración, de que sabemos con quiénes trabajamos y de que tenemos los mecanismos para hacerlo. Y a pesar de ello, como sabemos todos, estamos muy bloqueados en muchas políticas y no se avanza, y hay bloqueos y hay diferencias nacionales y seguimos un poco, hay medidas regulatorias, pero no se llega a proveer una respuesta conjunta y ordenada a muchos de estos problemas. Y esto es así en gran parte, como decías en la introducción, ¿por qué no tenemos más Europa social? ¿Necesitamos más Europa social o no? Yo diría que sí necesitamos más Europa social, pero igual necesitamos plantear esta necesidad de una Europa más social de una manera que no es como la estábamos planteando antes. Porque muchas veces cuando se habla de más integración económica, lo típico que se escucha es no, esto no puede suceder porque el norte va a pagar por el sur, porque los países más ricos o con más superávit no van a ponerse de acuerdo nunca para esto. Y eso es porque seguimos teniendo una concepción muy nacional de Europa en la que pensamos, tenemos ricos y pobres y si nos integramos, los ricos van a pagar por los pobres. Pero igual lo que tenemos, y esta noción de ricos pagando por pobres parte de una idea del estado del bienestar muy de la posguerra, muy de antiguas funciones del estado del bienestar, muy de transferir dinero de unos a otros. Y una crítica que creo que es muy interesante que hace Branko Milanovic en su libro Global Inequality es que igual deberíamos dejar de pensar tanto en redistribución o dejar de pensar solo en redistribución, porque la redistribución es importante cuando hablamos de política social, y pararnos a pensar en qué es lo que pasa antes. ¿Cómo se puede minimizar la necesidad de redistribución? Y un poco en esta línea y en la línea también del filósofo Amartya Sen y su idea de capacitar a las personas, yo creo que una manera de la cual Europa podría ir hacia más integración económica y hacia más integración social sin necesariamente crear conflictos políticos por redistribución es si el foco no fuese en unos pagando por otros, sino en activar a las personas, activar a los ciudadanos con políticas de inversión social que permitiesen igualar el punto de partida y aumentar la igualdad de oportunidades, de modo que no sea necesario o tan necesario, porque siempre va a ser necesario al final, redistribuir después. Y esto es algo en lo que la Unión Europea al final podría llegar a tener muchísimo margen de acción. Si nos centrásemos no tanto en decir tenemos un presupuesto común europeo y tenemos una política fiscal como la pensamos a nivel nacional, sino si nos centrásemos más en políticas como políticas de mercado laboral activas, políticas de educación, políticas de activación, porque al fin y al cabo la transición hacia una economía de servicios, la desigualdad, la precariedad laboral, son elementos comunes a todos los países europeos. Y todos los países europeos, seas España o seas Finlandia, comparten el objetivo de tener una mayor igualdad de oportunidades. Entonces, si esta mayor integración económica y mayor integración social no se plantease tanto desde el punto de vista de corregir, sino desde el punto de vista de prevenir y enfrentarse a retos comunes en términos de igualdad, de igualar el campo de juego para todos los ciudadanos europeos, yo creo que es algo donde la Unión Europea, dentro del marco actual y dentro del tipo de políticas y de arreglos macroeconómicos que tenemos, se podría avanzar muchísimo más y se podría avanzar de una manera mucho más adaptada al tipo de retos al que nos enfrentamos a día de hoy. Era un poco mi reflexión inicial.
Muchas gracias, Arián. Y ahora tenemos a Miguel Otero. He olvidado antes mencionar su afiliación con el Real Instituto Elcano y con el Instituto Empresa.
Pues buenos días a todos. Es realmente un placer estar aquí, gracias a los organizadores. Un placer estar también con el profesor Collier. Bueno, yo llevo analizando esta temática desde hace años, desde la economía política, ¿no? Que es a lo que me dedico. Y yo quería empezar por el problema más gordo que tenemos y al que aludió el profesor Collier, que es que en los últimos 20 años se ha roto el ascensor social en prácticamente todos los países de la OCDE, ¿no? Y ese es el mayor problema, ¿no? Y eso viene un poco, pues como decía Ariane, de que no partimos de la misma piedra de inicio o escalera de inicio, sino que ya hay unas desigualdades enormes. Entonces, bueno, cuatro conceptos que creo que son importantes para analizar. Esos conceptos para mí son, el primero, meritocracia. ¿Realmente tenemos meritocracia? ¿Somos una sociedad meritocrática? El segundo concepto importante es voz. ¿Tiene la gente voz? ¿Se ve reflejada en las instituciones políticas? El tercero es empoderamiento. Se ha mencionado varias veces y yo creo que es más importante que el de que redistribución y compensación. Yo siempre lo discuto en el Cano con mi colega Federico Steinberg, él siempre está, hay que compensar a los perdedores. Yo estoy más a favor de empoderar a la gente desde el inicio. Y cuarto, importante, es competencia. Realmente tenemos una sociedad competitiva y tenemos competencia, ¿no? Brevemente, el primero, Anne Applebaum lo explica muy bien. ¿Por qué ha surgido el autoritarismo en Polonia? Y ha surgido porque realmente la gente se ha dado cuenta que la meritocracia solo funciona para algunos. El profesor Collier decía que venía de lo que se conoce en el Reino Unido como la working class. Pues yo también soy de la working class, ¿no? Soy de hijos inmigrantes gallegos que se fueron a Basilea, Suiza, y que entre los dos no tienen más de 10 años de escuela, ¿vale? Yo represento la Europa que tiene a alguien como yo que puede ser profesor en el Instituto de Empresa y investigador principal en el Real Instituto Elcano. Yo cuando veo mis alumnos en el Instituto de Empresa hoy, pienso que ellos parten ya con una ventaja tan grande que es muy difícil que alguien como yo en su día pueda lograr el ascensor social que hemos logrado el profesor Collier y yo. Y entonces en Polonia la sensación fue esa, es decir, después de la caída del muro nos decían que esta es una sociedad liberal meritocrática, pero los que tenían la posibilidad de ascender eran aquellos que sus padres habían mandado al Reino Unido y a Estados Unidos a estudiar. Entonces, la sociedad estaba gobernada por ellos, por la élite metropolitana polaca. Y eso, para ellos, eso no es meritocrático. Eso es alguien que tiene privilegios y manda. Y yo, que soy de la zona rural, pues no tengo ninguna posibilidad. No hablo inglés, no tengo ninguna posibilidad. Entonces, ¿qué es lo que me atrae frente a la meritocracia? La lealtad. La lealtad de partido. La lealtad al PiS, al partido autoritario, ¿no? de los Kaczynski, porque yo ahí, si soy leal al partido, puedo escalar. Entonces, eso, que es una estructura más jerárquica, autoritaria, para muchos es una estructura más móvil. Entonces subes en la escala social porque tienes lealtad a tu jefe y vas escalando. Entonces dices, oye, lo democrático meritocrático no funcionaba, lo autoritario y leal, eso sí que funciona. Eso es potente, eso, y lo tenemos en muchas otras sociedades. Segundo, voz. Bueno, los gilets jaunes es que no tienen voz. La France Périphérique justamente es, bueno, es que no, yo no me veo reflejado en esa élite que está gobernando. Yo no me veo reflejado, yo estudié en Oxford, yo no me veo reflejado en Oxbridge, yo no me veo reflejado en Ivy League. Esa gente es mucho más progre que yo, para resumirlo. Es mucho más posmoderna, posmaterial que yo. Y aparte, en los medios de comunicación nacionales solo aparece Londres, Madrid y solo aparecen los centros metropolitanos. Mis historias no aparecen. El periodismo no cubre lo mío. Por lo tanto, yo no tengo voz. Potente. ¿Cómo se arregla eso? Yo creo que uno de los problemas que tenía, y el profesor Collier lo decía, es, yo lo veo mucho en mis entornos, la poca empatía que hay por algo que algunos han incluso llamado chusma, por la gente corriente. Y esa falta de empatía yo creo que viene por la falta de socialización. Yo lo veo en mis alumnos que desde que nacen prácticamente hasta que llegan a puestos de poder ya no se relacionan. Y ahora en el mundo del Netflix, en el mundo de incluso de relaciones sociales y sexuales por internet, ya no tienes que ni rozarte, ya no tienes que ir ni a la discoteca a ligar. Entonces ya no tienes espacios comunes. El espacio común que era vital para relacionarse entre clases sociales era ¿cuál? El ejército. En su día, cuando tú ibas al servicio militar, te relacionabas con otras clases sociales. Nosotros ni eso tenemos. Entonces llega un momento en que ya estamos en burbujas que no se tocan. Entonces, ¿cómo hacemos a nivel europeo de que se toquen? Mi propuesta es, no, porque eso sí que en el Reino Unido la gente se levanta en armas. No pido un ejército europeo, pero sí que pido una especie de servicio anual europeo donde la gente tenga que hacer durante un año ese servicio para servicio público europeo que las clases... Tenemos que buscar algo donde... Porque yo soy un apasionado del fútbol. Una de las maneras, una de las grandes cosas que tiene el fútbol es que une a clases sociales. Yo estudié en los Maristas de La Coruña y entonces cuando jugábamos en el Victoria de La Coruña, pues estaba la gente de barrio y estábamos nosotros y ahí nos uníamos. Pero ya casi ni eso está pasando, porque ya mucha gente, pues ya no, el fútbol ya ahora ya es menos cool de lo que era, ¿no? Entonces, empoderar significa formación, para mí formación dual. Los países que tienen formación dual son de los países más cohesionados, porque la gente que realmente no llega a la universidad y que abandona, y en España tenemos mucho abandono escolar, esa gente está perdida. Y esa gente no tiene empoderamiento. Esa gente es la que dice que ya no tiene autonomía. Entonces, los países donde hay más cohesión social, Dinamarca, Austria, Suiza, incluso Alemania, tienen una formación dual importante. Y después, el tema de medios de comunicación y cubrir las historias de la periferia. Eso es clave. Si los medios de comunicación solo se centran en las grandes ciudades, estamos perdidos. Y acabo con el último, que es competencia, ¿no? Y esto ya es más macro. Pero uno de los grandes problemas, si lo sabéis, es que con la digitalización tenemos una concentración de poder en unas plataformas y unas empresas que al final hacen que haya mucha productividad en ese pico de la pirámide, pero que no se filtra. Entonces, los macroeconomistas nos preguntamos, ¿pero por qué no crece la productividad si estamos en una era de la revolución digital? Bueno, en parte es porque todo está concentrado en diferentes empresas fronteras y no filtra, y entonces necesitamos otra vez, yo creo que la izquierda tiene que coger la bandera de la competencia, o sea, antitrust y antimonopolio y anticartel, eso debería ser la gran bandera de la izquierda, porque es realmente tienes que romper eso, ¿no? Y acabo con, y no solamente hay competencia dentro del mundo empresarial, no solamente en el mundo empresarial esto, hay también en países. Yo hago mucho análisis sobre, por ejemplo, el tema, ¿no?, de inversión extranjera. Los países que más inversión extranjera tienen en España, ¿sabéis cuáles son? Luxemburgo y Holanda. Esos dos países tienen un monopolio. Y entonces, en los últimos diálogos que nosotros tenemos, a estar en el Cano, tenemos diálogos con nuestras contrapartes. Yo cuando voy a La Haya, es que me parece increíble. Hemos hablado, y acabo con el pilar social, que creo que es lo que queremos abordar hoy. La última vez que estuve en La Haya, me dijeron que ellos están a favor del pilar social europeo. Les parece una gran idea. Pero bajo tres condiciones. Primera, la política fiscal se mantiene a nivel nacional. Dos, la política social se mantiene a nivel nacional. Y tres, el control de las fronteras y la migración y refugiados se mantiene a nivel nacional. Bueno, yo creo que hay una contradicción en términos en la Europa que queremos, porque bueno, si queremos ir hacia donde dice Ariana que tenemos que ir, pues necesitamos una política social paneuropea, ¿no? Lo dejo aquí, gracias.
La verdad, fascinante el conjunto de ideas desde la igualación de oportunidades, que es una propuesta pragmática, esta meritocracia más voz, más empoderamiento, más competencia. Now let's engage in the discussion, but I understand that Professor Collier wants to say something before we go to you.
Just for a couple of minutes, response to these really excellent. So, Miguel, let me give you one example of this social segmentation, which is quite pronounced. So, the most common discussion amongst my fellow Remainers in Oxford is this: the statement, not only do I not know anybody who voted for Brexit, I don't know anybody who knows anybody who voted for Brexit. But 52% of the country voted for Brexit, right? This is terrible. This is just a repeat of this statement. You know, we become two nations. But mainly I wanted to turn to Ariane's really excellent points, because what you pointed to was that I didn't discuss the solutions I propose, but they are exactly the things that concern you. So one is that what we need to redistribute is not consumption, it is productivity. We need to bring productivity to the places where people belong. The answer to becoming productive cannot be move to Barcelona, right? Or move to London, right? We have to be able to bring productivity to place. We can't bring productivity to every little village and town, but we can make absolutely sure that every region in Europe has a productive city that gives hope and purpose to the youth of that region. So how do we do that? Well, we need more Edinburghs. That's why I went through Edinburgh. Edinburgh's got the package that basically works, and we need to build that package. It won't be done just by the market. The market does not automatically revive broken cities. Broken cities like Sheffield fill up with, because of cheap wages and cheap property, they fill up with junk jobs. And those junk jobs take people off the skill escalator. So half of the problem is bring jobs, productive jobs, to place. And the other half of the problem is equip young people to be productive in those jobs. And that is what I call the social maternal chain. And I start with the fetus in the mother's womb, and I go through to a 20-year-old who's going to be in a job. And I focus entirely on the bottom half of the population that is not going to go to university. University for everybody is a stupid idea. Right? So I start with the fetus because, and here's some damning evidence, right? There's a new Finnish study which looks at stressed pregnant mothers, women who face stress during pregnancy. And they've tracked 40 years on from that time of stress. And the adults, now 40 years old, are significantly and substantially dysfunctional if the mother was stressed during pregnancy. So the damage is irreversible, but it's entirely fixable. What is the conditions for that stress? It's inadequate support during that period of pregnancy. Okay? And so we need absolutely to gear up our social policies to help stressed young families, instead of scrutinizing them, encouraging them, basically helping them fall apart. Preschool. We know that by the age of 6, academic performance at 12 can be almost perfectly predicted. So the game is up by 6. Preschool, there's huge variation in Europe, around Europe. We can learn from what works best. To my mind, what works best in Europe preschool is France with École Maternelle. It's free, it's standard, it's state-provided, it's very easy to provide it. Everybody goes, because everybody goes, the children of the poor who need it most, they go. What do they learn in École Maternelle? They learn to be socialized. It's not the cognitive skills, it's the precognitive skills. We now know that if you don't get the social skills, you can't even begin to build the cognitive skills. So, preschool, it's just that, certainly in Britain, Pregnancy to 5 is a disaster zone. We put all the emphasis on schools. Schools are overloaded with obligations. There's a really severe limit to what schools can do. There's a brilliant study by Robert Putnam shows basically schools are sites where children come together and it amplifies the culture of the house, of the family. So in Britain, the middle-class kids, their parents buy homes in middle-class areas, so they all go to middle-class schools, so the culture of the family is good, and so that the school just amplifies that. Yeah. In the areas of broken homes, all the children of the broken homes go to the same school, it amplifies that. That's what schools do. Yeah. So the idea that we can, by testing, monitoring, supervising teachers, turn people around, that's just false. And then post-school, learn from variation in Europe. To my mind, the most successful in Europe is Switzerland. Switzerland has a world top 10 university at Zurich. But 60% of Swiss kids choose not to go to university because the vocational route is as prestigious. You can end up running a Swiss bank through the vocational route. Yeah? What you do is 3 and 4 year courses with very prestigious credentials at the end. It's paid. Whilst people are doing this, they're paid. It's wildly expensive. But here's the killer. Half the money comes from firms. And it's locally organized. So within a city, the business community funds half the cost of that training. Why does that matter? Because the only way the vocational training works is if the firms and the local firms are in the kitchen of what gets trained, what skills get built. And in Switzerland, the firms have got so much skin in the game, so much money in it, that they make absolutely sure that these kids come out productive. Britain, which has brilliant universities for the cognitively gifted, if you're not in that lucky group, Britain is disastrous. Huh? So that's it very much builds on what you were suggesting.
Okay, no, thank you very much. Now to optimize the 20 minutes that we have left, I'm myself being an Ivy Leaguer, I always admired the Oxbridge tradition to ask short questions for 1 minute replies. So, ahora vamos al turno de preguntas y respuestas. Por favor, muy corta la pregunta. Sí, adelante.
Sí, buenas tardes. Gracias por las presentaciones. Como eurófilo de adopción, nací en Sudamérica, así llevo 35 años viviendo en España, parece ser que la Europa es parte de la solución. Y me parece que parte del problema son los países que forman la Unión Europea. Mi pregunta es muy clara. ¿Qué posibilidades ven ustedes que los países de la Unión Europea acepten ceder competencias y soberanía a la Unión Europea para poder solucionar los problemas, entre ellos el tema del contrato social? Ha comentado antes, señor Otero, que los países, por ejemplo Holanda, no quieren saber nada de la posibilidad de igualar, por ejemplo, el tratamiento fiscal a nivel de los países de Europa, que yo creo que es un problema. No podemos seguir viviendo con una Irlanda que cobra un 12% de impuestos de sociedades a las empresas cuando aquí se cobra el 25%. Y ojo, soy empresario. Pero bueno, si no armonizamos, no vamos a ningún sitio. Pero ¿qué posibilidades políticas reales hay de que esto ocurra? Gracias.
¿Quién quiere tomarlo? ¿Tú?
Sí, estoy feliz. He trabajado mucho con el gobierno alemán. And the German population has persuaded itself that it's bitterly opposed to what it calls a transfer union, by which it means any European budget used to help poorer places. What I try and tell the Germans is that Europe already is a massive transfer union, but it doesn't work through the 1% of Europe's GDP that goes through Brussels. It works through the common economic policies. In particular, the euro The euro was a double move. It was a move to a common currency, but it was also a move to... if you're going to do a common currency, you could have done a common currency with the lira. You could have said, all of Europe now has the lira. Right? If you'd had that, Germans would have had to be a big psychological adjustment. Right? Instead, what we did was say, common currency, and the common currency is going to be the Deutschmark. And that meant all the countries which were not inflation-phobic. Germany has a very peculiar attitude to inflation. If you look at surveys of Germans, they rate inflation as worse than getting cancer. Right? So they're inflation-phobic, right? And they're also deficit-phobic, because Chancellor Merkel and Finance Minister Schäuble built this idea of the black zero and all that, sort of, you know, the Schwabian housewife, economically illiterate concepts that have stuck with people. And so the German population has unfortunately been persuaded to some basic economic fallacies, and they've persuaded themselves that they are the victims of a transfer union, because a tiny little bit of 1% of GDP is being spent in other countries, when actually what I tell them is you are massive beneficiaries of a very powerful transfer union, which is worked through the exchange rate. Germany has got a very substantially undervalued real exchange rate, and Southern Europe has got a very substantially overvalued real exchange rate, and this has produced a massive redistribution from Southern Europe to Germany. And so Europe is a transfer union, with Germany the big beneficiary, right? We can't undo that, though we should never have got into it. This was a piece of economic illiteracy, going to a common Deutschmark everywhere, I think. But we do need to get equally powerful mechanisms to offset it. And at the moment, we haven't got them. Right? As you quite correctly say about taxes, and Luxembourg, why is Luxembourg so central? Because there was one guy who was first finance minister and then prime minister of Luxembourg, a man called Juncker, who built a wonderful tax avoidance scheme which Luxembourg benefits from. And that's why 40% of Europe's companies are now registered in Luxembourg. It's not that Luxembourg's doing any business, it's just a haven for corporate tax avoidance. Right? So this is just an ethical disgrace. It has to be called out for what it is. Right? And I've found, I do quite a lot of public policy activism, and I found some things are far too hard to change, but some things are rather easy to change. And it's not just where are their vested interests. There are vested interests everywhere. That stops change anyway. The real thing is, are the vested interests willing to stand up and defend the status quo? And with corporate tax avoidance, actually, companies are pretty quiet about it, because they don't really like to stand up and say, of course we should have the right to pay no tax. And so this is a winnable fight, getting a common corporate tax rate, or at least a high minimum corporate tax rate. That's winnable. Right? And persuading the Germans to pay more tax to the rest of us, that's hard. Because the citizens of Germany, the problem is not the vested interest, it's the problem that the citizens of Germany haven't understood how big they are, how powerfully they're benefiting from redistribution. That's the battle we need to win. If we can win that, then they'll concede.
Okay, great point. I think Ariane has a comment.
Yes, just very shortly, just for adding another perspective to your question, which I think is very interesting. I think that thinking about an European social policy in terms of all or nothing, so in terms of either we have fiscal harmonization and full pan-European social policy, as Miguel was mentioning before, is part of the reason why we don't have a solution. In the European Union, we have this so-called principle of subsidiarity, which tells us that policies should be done at a level which is as high as needed and as low as possible. And I don't think we need to have everything going supranational. It does make sense to have some taxes at the local, at the regional, at the national, probably at the European level too. And the same applies for social policies. Some policies are going to be implemented better depending on regional needs, depending on local needs, depending on national needs. But what I think there is room for is for certain policies to go supranational. And that's probably going to entail some kind of more fiscal transfers. That may be the case. We already have certain fiscal transfers going on in Europe. We have seen how regional and cohesion policy has evolved a lot in order to be more sustainable, to support certain aims. And I think that that direction that cohesion policy has already taken can be a tool and a way for social policy to go in there too. We also have tools with the European semester that may allow for a certain framework of social policy that doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to lose all national sovereignty. So I think there is some kind of room in the middle which doesn't entail all or nothing and whether the solution may go through.
Thank you. Miguel, do you want to qualify?
I think, you see, how do political communities evolve? Usually they evolve because you have an adversary, because you have external threats. And coming back to the Netherlands, I see there's a... And the Netherlands is a proxy for Germany, essentially. It's a small Germany. In the Netherlands, people are realizing that if you want to compete with the United States and China, you need Europe. The Netherlands cannot do it alone. And so there's a transformation happening there. In Germany as well, for a long time, you know, when it comes to China, they thought we have this honeymoon with the Chinese, we have this bilateral relationship with them. But then suddenly they realized, you know, the Chinese, they would just push them around and they needed Europe. And so, I don't believe in the United States of Europe. I don't think it will ever happen. But I believe in this, you know, subsidiarity-based kind of multi-level governance in Europe and for certain public goods. And for certain external threats, you need common resources, right? And at some point, I mean, you know, there was this thing about no taxation without representation. My idea is that in Europe, you don't have participation without taxation. At some point, you need to tax people for people to engage with Europe. And coming back to who should pay, I don't think that this should be kind of national-based or regional-based. I think it should be, you know, at the individual and corporate level-based, right? I mean, everyone that uses the single market being the most important common good that we have in Europe, then you pay a tax. Right? This morning I had to pay a little tax because of the tourist tax that there is in Barcelona, right? Well, if you, you know, if you use the single market as a corporation, or if you travel, for example, those of us that travel a lot within Europe, in the single space of the European Union, why don't apply a little tax there, right? And so there, I mean, and I think the historical reference is the Holy Roman Empire, right? I mean, the Holy Roman Empire, as you know, I think Rousseau was the one saying that wasn't really holy. It wasn't certainly not Roman. It was not an empire, right? But it lasted 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And when you had external threats, the emperor was able to receive resources from every corner. This was not a homogeneous, top-down state that was... No, this was very loose, very, very kind of, you know, fragmented, very, very kind of decentralized. But for certain things, you need the level of centralization to have the resources to cover, you know, the problems that you have in the community as a whole.
Okay, thank you. Más preguntas breves para respuestas breves. Sí, claro. No, todavía tenemos 7 minutos.
Thanks so much, Professor Collier. It's a very, very inspiring. We want to share with you just that here from the Cercle d'Economia, We are working on several of the items that you mentioned in the panel, so it's very also rewarding. We're working on inclusive capitalism. We're working on the purpose of the company, what you call the firms. We're working, it was very interesting, Ariane, because we're also working on the concept of the instead of the redistribution, the ex-ante policies, instead of the ex-post policies, we want to dedicate a lot of time and effort into that, education, equality of opportunities. We're also working on more competition, and we are very surprised that the left seems to be against competition, while I think the beneficiaries of the competition are actually all of us, no, the people. And instead of that, the left seems to be always against competition. We've had good examples here in this town with public services, for example. And I think the left should bear the leadership of more competition. And I would like to understand from you, Miguel, why don't you think that's the case? And then we're also working, and that's a question for you, Professor, we're also working on redistribution of the benefits of the centrality. We have this problem also here in Spain. You mentioned Barcelona, but a lot of the benefits of the centrality in this country are remaining in Madrid. You have the problem in London, you have the problem in Paris, and on the conversations we've had with the stakeholders, it's extremely difficult to convince the elites of these cities to centralize and to distribute those benefits. Very, very difficult. Very easy to say, but extremely difficult to do. And when you look at the pragmatic issues, all of us are living in those cities that are the beneficiaries of the centrality. I don't know, Ariane, where you live, but
in Florence.
But you live in Paris, you live in Madrid, you live in London, you live in Madrid, you live in Barcelona. So it's very easy to say. It's then extremely hard how we make it possible. If it's we think it should be driven by the states, but the truth is that so far we have not been able to do it.
Okay, let me answer that one, right? It's an important part of the book. It's me wearing my hat as a sort of economic theorist, but a lot of the gains from productivity in the metropolitan areas, why are this productivity so high? Right? And the answer that the metropolitan successful like to give is because I'm so absolutely brilliant. Right? I'm really productive because I'm really full of merit, and so I deserve it. Right? And that's partly true, but it's only partly true. Because the real reason those people are so productive is that they're all together in one big agglomeration. And so you've got all these interdependent skills which become hugely productive, not because of their individual genius, but because of their interdependence in a very proximate space. And that is the concept in economics, is the rents of agglomeration. And the question then becomes, to whom should those rents of agglomeration belong? And the answer is, they should belong to all the people who contributed to the ability of the agglomeration to function. And that's typically about two centuries of physical infrastructure and political infrastructure, legal infrastructure, that were sort of national struggles. And so the answer is a lot of those rents of agglomeration belong to everybody. Now, until my work with Tony Venables, the answer to who actually captures them was the people who own the land in the cities and the property. You know, the first billionaire in Britain was the Duke of Westminster. And what was his great contribution to the success of London? Well, he owned the land. he didn't do anything, he just owned the land. So he became the first billionaire. That was capturing the rents of agglomeration just because of being a landowner. But what Venables and I have shown is that in a modern economy, a lot of the rents of agglomeration, probably half of them, get captured by the skilled. And that's what they're doing. They're capturing rents. They're not brilliantly productive because they're individually brilliant. They're very rich because they're capturing these rents that should belong to the whole country. And so that's a subtle concept to get across. But once it gradually percolates, it's equivalent to Germans finally waking up to the fact that they are massive beneficiaries of a transfer union, because it changes the ethical basis. At the moment, Germans think of themselves as victims of a heist by Southern Europe. Once they realize they are massive beneficiaries of a powerful transfer from Southern Europe, the whole tone of the conversation will change. Once the metropolitan skilled start to realize that they don't deserve to peel off from shared obligations to others because they're super brilliant, but that actually they're rich because they've stolen what belonged to others, then again, it becomes much easier to have these necessary redistributions. But it's combined with this narrative. Why do we need these redistributions? It is not to put the poor regions on benefit street, to give them a load of consumption. It's to bring productivity to those regions, bring skill to those regions. So, as Ariana said, these people actually become productive.
Thank you. So we have 1 minute final remarks for Ariane and Miguel.
Well, first of all, it's been such a pleasure to be here to share a bit of what we all think about the future of the European social contract. I hope you all leave this room with maybe some new ideas on how you think the European Union should move on. But it's in any case, it's been very interesting. And I think that certain points that we have raised here, like redistributing productivity not only among individuals but also across regions, whether these regions should be within country or within at an European level, I think that's something that should be explored more deeply, because in the end we do know that we have winners and losers, but identifying those losers and identifying what to do in the conditions that we have nowadays, and knowing that we are not going to go to an economy which works as it did 40 years ago. So what do we do with those losers of technological change or those losers of globalization, so that they feel empowered again, so that they have voice again, as you were saying, and they feel represented, and they have the opportunity of being productive? I think that's the main challenge that we are facing nowadays.
Thank you. Miguel?
Well, I'm going to address the question of the president. I was always puzzled about how in this country the term competition is usually negative, right? But when we talk about sports, this country is super competitive. And we admire those that are ultra competitive, like Rafael Nadal, right? So this kind of contradiction here. And for the left, I guess I think the past, and this relates to what I said about Poland, the feeling was always more competition helps the strong. Because if you have more competition, usually that's not a level playing field. It's because certain people have more privileges, and therefore, more competition will produce more inequality, right? And it's very interesting to see that in sports, we don't have that feeling, right? We feel that if you are a very good footballer, it doesn't matter how much your parents earn or how much your mother went to school, you will make it, right? So the football in this country is meritocratic, right? But competition in economics or politics, not so much. And I think, Professor Collier talked about Switzerland. I was raised there, I lived there, and I think there's only a few countries more competitive than the Swiss, right? The Swiss, they wake up in the morning and they always feel that someone will eat their lunch. Every day, right? They're obsessed about that, right? But they are very keen on that everyone should have good skills from the start, right? And so I would encourage those that are here, entrepreneurs or businessmen, etc., to really follow up on what Professor Collier said about dual vocational training systems, because that's really what empowers a lot of people, and that gives the skills for some, so that perhaps one day the left realizes that competition can be fair.
Let me return for 1 minute to your question, Jose Manuel.
Okay.
What should Europe do? We need a commitment which is the Draghi commitment, we'll do whatever it takes, but not the purpose being to save Europe's Deutschmark commitment, but to achieve social convergence across Europe. We need to say the 2020s, the European Commission will do whatever it takes to achieve social convergence in Europe.
So great conclusion. So let's thank our panelists with a big round of applause.